Today I want to talk about Stalinism, and in doing so, you know, 15 years ago, lots of what we now know about the Soviet Union through its entire history, we didn't know because the archives weren't open. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, fell apart, disintegrated. In the early 1990s, gradually lots of the archives were open. And so what I have to say today, I don't work in the Soviet Union, but draws upon the work of Michael Holquist, not Michael Holquist, that's his dad, of, God, what a bêtise, Holquist. Anyway, he used to teach at Cornell and now teaches at Princeton. And work also, more recent work on Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick. So let me just lay out the overview at the beginning. And I sent around this morning. I didn't get home till real late last night, so I sent along about 12:30 in the morning various terms, but I forgot a couple: democratic centralism, right opposition, and Bukharin. But this is stuff's all in the book. So I hope you're able to get that, and I'll do the same for next time. So the question remains did Lenin inevitably lead to Stalin, and that's a hard one. I guess the structure of what became morphed into the Soviet regime was set the way that the Bolshevik Party operated even before taking power, and a fundamental concept was democratic centralism. And that is it's the way that the Soviet state became organized. It's a top-down way of making decisions and sending out a relevant communication. In principle, it was supposed to involve debate. At the highest levels, and then once decisions were taken, then they were communicated through the Communist Party. But of course, the paranoia of Stalin, he was a clinical paranoid, and this paranoia led to the deaths of millions of people. But debate itself became, as a concept under Stalinism, identified with anti-Soviet behavior, and so essentially, what had been begun as a popular revolution on behalf of the working people, and also to an extent on behalf of nationalities, became the dictatorship, not of the proletariat, but of the Communist Party, of the Bolshevik Party transformed into the Communist Party, and the dictatorship of Stalin. And of course, as his paranoia increased, the purges followed, the big show trials, some of which were Western communists went and sat and listened to hear people confess to having been in cahoots with Nazis or with English royalists or whomever, and confess to things that they certainly had never done. Not long before their execution. And so one of the points to be made today is following Holquist, is that the structure of the Stalinist terror, there were antecedents that one could see in the Civil War and in the period of Lenin's domination in the early years of the Soviet Union, but that very quickly, very early on, that the people who imagined that nationalities would have autonomy, those hopes were destroyed quite quickly, and Stalin had been a minister or whatever they called it, commissar of nationalities, and the idea that workers' self-management, self-control, control of the means of production, would be implemented in this new a brave world were shattered rather quickly with strikes and protests by workers smashed by the police by the Soviet state, and of course the illusion would be perpetuated in the 20s and even in the 30s that this was a true a workers' paradise and that everything was groovy. But the talk was always about the radiant future, and the radiant was a word that they used a lot, that the future, and I'll talk more about this in a while, would be radiant, it would be glorious, but the sacrifices had to be made now, and they had to be made now to protect the revolution against the Americans, against the French, and against the British, and the powers of capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, as you all know, it never came to be. And that's the tragedy of the Russian Revolution. More about this in a while. But certainly, first of all, as backdrop to all of this, because of the Civil War and because of the famine conditions and because of just enormous economic hardship. Trying to have a state was not clear how this could this possibly be done, and you've got a country with all these nationalities and which is basically still essentially a country of peasants despite the industrial work in the Ural Mountains and in the mines and in what town that became Petrograd became Leningrad, obviously later. So you're going to how to do this, and the war itself, as in all of the countries that participated in World War I, had done enormous ravages. I mean, the Germans are fighting inside Russia, and the subsequent civil war that decimated large parts of the countryside left the country barely able to function. Between 1921 and 1922, or in 1921 and 1922, this is in what you're reading, more than 7 million people died of starvation and sickness during that period. And remember, the wars go on. The war against Poland goes on until finally the situation is resolved with the Treaty of Riga in 1921, which I don't think is in your book. But Lenin implemented the new economic policy, and as he and the other Soviet leaders grappled with a country in virtual collapse, he recognized that the ideology of communism, which called for the abolition of private property, private ownership, and the destruction of the free market would have to be sacrificed for the future, because you simply had to be able to feed people. You had to have peasants not hoarding what they produced or waiting for higher prices. You needed to have a free market system, at least for a while, because of the fact that people resisted what was called war communism, which was sort of a shock communist therapy that had proved not to really work at all. And so the new economic policy is promulgated in March of 1921, and the features you can read about. But basically, the state maintains its centralized control over the economy, and there's still centralized planning. But the NEP allowed peasants to use their land as if it was their own, and largely, in most cases, it still was, and allowed markets to allow them to market their products and sell them at market prices in order to get food on food to people who needed it. Otherwise, they too would have died. And the state can maintain its control over heavy industry. But this is all going to be just a small retreat along the road to socialism. Now, it succeeded. It succeeded. It works. And gradually, the production of food reached pre-war levels, and small-scale industrial production revives. Now, another name I should have written on the board, of course. I was so tired when I did all this last night, is, of course, kulaks. And so two groups of people who profited during this period, two groups of people, would in the long memory of the communist leadership, get theirs during the five-year plan. The first are those people who, for example, were small merchants, or not in size, but you know, they sold products on the free market and did very, very well during this period of the new economic policy, and they became known as NEP men. NEP is the new economic policy, and the NEP men were people who did well during this period. And the other, and it's a term, as we'll see in a while, that became a term of denigration, and indeed could lead you straight to the gulag, if you were lucky, and weren't executed before that, and these were kulaks. And kulaks basically were prosperous peasants. They were well-off peasants. And during the period of the new economic policy, the kulaks, people with land who had something to sell, you know, did well indeed, because their goods fetched good prices, and they did very well. But with the gradual ending of the new economic policy, which sort of trickles to an end, after Lenin, that they would become targets in the mass collectivization campaign that accompanied the five-year plan, that is 1928 to 1933, and would be themselves victims of the purges, as we'll see. And of course, one of the great tragedies, the tragedy of the Russian Revolution, I mean, there's a quote in there from I guess it was somebody in the Red Army who says, did we do all this? Did we fight in the Civil War? Did we try to save the revolution against some really basically horrible legions in the white armies during the Civil War? Did we save the revolution in order to round up kulaks and put them in the middle of a field and line them up in the middle of a field and gun them down with machine guns to kill them? Did we do all of this to eliminate from the face of the earth these people who had, despite being relatively privileged, had struggled and had managed to survive the whole thing? And sadly, the answer is yes. I mean, it came to that. And the question is, to what extent was this automatically built? Was this part of the system from the beginning? And I'll give you some examples that Holquist cites in a minute. And he says you can see this coming if you look at the first years of the Soviet people. Let me give you some examples of this. And this is before the period where Stalin becomes a successor. I mean, Stalin worked very hard to make it seem as Lenin he had one stroke and then another, and Stalin tried to keep access closed to other people, and he worked feverishly to make it seem that Stalin was the chosen successor of Lenin. And there are some famous doctored photographs where Stalin has had himself inserted next to Lenin in famous poses of Lenin, who was a pretty good speaker. Nothing like Trotsky. Trotsky was Jean Jaurès, was the greatest orator of the entire period. But Lenin wasn't too bad. And Stalin literally had himself stuck into to pictures where he would be there. And he also took some of Lenin's writings and sort of, quote unquote, updated them with his. To make it seem like he the mantle was there, and everybody, as everybody knows, I mean, who follows this stuff at all, that Lenin was in his final days most concerned that Comrade Stalin that his leadership was potentially very dangerous. And he expressed those fears in the letter, if I remember correctly, written with a very shaky hand of a man who had had a stroke, a very serious stroke, and then who was close to death. He had his doubts about Comrade Stalin, not exactly from the beginning. And also, it's important to note that Trotsky, whom as I said the other day would finally be tracked down and assassinated in a garden in Mexico City, that the differences between Trotsky and Stalin, of course, they went beyond ideology. Trotsky was in what became known as the left opposition. That was pushing for more active instigation of revolutions in other places, and ironically was pushing even more for collectivization even early on. But it went more than that. I mean, there was a rivalry between two men who both were extraordinarily sure of themselves and who thought that they were. That they were the person who should lead, first save and then lead the Soviet Union. And of course, Trotsky's role in the Red Army as a strategist was extremely important. But there was more than that also. There was a more than a small trace of anti-Semitism in Stalin, and when he would refer to cosmopolitan enemies and things like that, and cosmopolitanism was sort of a code word for Jews, for Jewish people within the party, and there was more than that. But Trotsky, of course, is expelled from the party and finally is tracked down and killed. And some of these, as you know from reading Orwell, some of these these factions and these differences play themselves out in this anticipation of World War II that was the Spanish Civil War. And the Trotskyists are a very, very important faction in the Spanish Civil War. And of course, as you know from reading Orwell, the role of the Stalinists in all of this. Just a few things before I turn to Holquist's argument about how some of this, you can see some of the horrors coming early on. Let me just define a Stalinism, as a term. And here I'm drawing on Holquist. That is a set of tenets, policies, and practices that characterized the Soviet government, during the period when Stalin is in power. And Stalinism lasts until Stalin finally dies. When is it? 1953. Yeah, that is when Stalin dies. And the beginning of the five-year plan, that is 1928 to 1933, is really the real beginning of Stalinism. Though you can anticipate some of this, as we'll see in a minute. Stalinism not only takes a sort of democratic centralism of decision making, but what it does is it employs a state coercion and, where more than this, state terror, with the goal of transforming this still relatively backward society into a Soviet state that could sustain itself, that could build heavy industries. And this was the obsession of Stalin and Stalinism, that heavy industries would have to be built and that they would be built on the backs of the peasantry, who would lose their land and become industrial workers. There's a massive urbanization, as we'll see, in the Soviet Union during this period. And the obvious central characteristics of Stalinism, as you've already seen, are the abolition of private property, first of all, and the end of free trade, the end of the market. The market is to disappear. And if you're abolishing private property in a vast, vast state in which, two generations before you still had serfs, what you want to do, from their point of view, is collectivize agriculture. The massive collectivization of agriculture. And this would, as you know, become a characteristic of the satellite states in Eastern Europe and Eastern Central Europe, with varying degrees. varying degrees in those states. But the economy is planned, it's run in a centralized fashion, and predicated upon mass industries, rapid industrialization. And part of this was the liquidation, not a nice word, of those exploiting classes, that is the bourgeois, the nepmen, the kulaks, the aristocrats, and the clergy. And so this involves deporting people to the gulags, or incarcerating them wherever they were, or incarcerating them in the gulags. And the purge, the terror, the political terror against alleged enemies, including those who disagreed with Stalin within the leadership of the Soviet Union. Thus, the purges that you can read about of the left opposition, of Zinoviev and Trotsky, and Bukharin's right opposition. And with this comes the cult of personality, that Stalin himself becomes, and I say this, in quotes, a czar-like figure. There are still truck drivers in Russia who have pictures of Stalin, in their trucks, and other people as well. And of course, this leads to, obviously, to kind of a half-baked political scientist interpretations that, well, you have a czarist state, you have an autocracy, and inevitably it becomes another autocracy with a czar-like figure, the cult of personality of Stalin. But you think of Mao's China, and there, the cult of personality, if anything, was even more than that, with the Little Red Book and all of this business. To repeat the obvious, the Soviet Union was the dictatorship of the Communist Party, and the dictatorship of the Communist Party was the dictatorship of Joseph Stalin and the paranoia of Joseph Stalin. Now, ironically, Stalin, as I'm sure you know, was not Russian. Even though the empire was largely run, the Soviet empire, and it was that, was largely run in the interests of Russia and Russians. Stalin was a Georgian. He was from the country in which all of these things have happened. And just the last 5 or 6 months, he started out as a seminary student. He was expelled for reading Marxist tracts. Like a lot of these people, he took aliases because he robbed banks to money for the Bolshevik Party. Stalin means in Russian "man of steel." That was his alias. That wasn't his original name. And he's a Georgian. Remember, as I just said, he becomes the minister of the Commissar of Nationalities, but determined to snap the head off of the Hydra of the danger of nationalist revival in these states, because communism in theory was antithetical to nationalism. Though ironically, as you all know, that it doesn't really work that way. And there were strongly nationalist communist states that still retained Hungary, for example, Czechoslovakia, for example, that retained, even within the satellite nature, a kind of a pride in trying to make it work, even in 1968, as Dubček in 1968, before the tanks roll into Prague, tries to make a human-faced a socialism with a Czech and Slovak face, but of course it doesn't work. Now, through the whole period, as everybody knows, they execute millions of people. In World War II, the figures of the number of Soviets who die in World War II is about 25 million people. Now, if you're thinking about Stalingrad, and you're thinking about the siege of Leningrad, which goes on and on and on and takes a million lives. But within that 25 million, lots of those people are people who died in the gulags. They did not die from reasons of war. They died in the gulags, and many of them were executed for you know, being a kulak or being a netman or whatever. Now, can you see this coming? Can one see this coming? Just a couple points along the way. That during World War I, states had increased their power, their ability to control what became sort of command economies, to mobilize the resources of the state. In Russia, in World War I, the imperial government, Holquist writes, initiated a deportation of quote-unquote the Jewish element. Now remember, the rabid anti-Semitism of the Tsar and Alexandra on the borderlines as, quote, pernicious, quote, harmful and dangerous to the Russian people, and thus thus, in wartime, they are they just as in Italy. Italy went to war in part so that they had the idea that they could somehow make citizens Italian, feel themselves Italian. There is this nature as the war is being fought in Russia that you will increase the Russianness of the effort of the empire, even though all these other nationalities are involved, by excluding people. Now, they're not excluding people by putting them up the wall and shooting them, but the language is somewhat there. For example, they describe the whites, who were a nasty group, many of them, and just nasty, bloodthirsty group, not all of them, but many of them. They describe the Jews as microbes. This is the whites describing the Jews as microbes, and Bolshevism is a social disease. I mean, the kind of disease metaphors are the next step is if you have a disease, if you have a cancer, you cut it out. You exclude it by cutting it out. And so the language of exclusion is already there. And at one point, the Soviets, in the very first part of the Soviet Union, began a program, what they call de-Cossackization. They want to remove an entire Cossack population, which they viewed as potentially disloyal to the revolution. But you can't do that. And I mean, it's just too hard to do that when all these other things are going on. So they don't really they can't do that. But in the early years, the Lenin years, there's still, you find these things. In 1921, there's a campaign against banditism. That is, bandits are people who don't support the communists. That term is often used, by the way, in France under Vichy, that they're the resistors are bandits or they're terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. And bandits become a dangerous epidemic. Again, the disease metaphor, they're dangerous because they are. In 1920, Stalin informed Trotsky, Holquist found, that an order would soon come directing, quote, the total extermination of the white officer corps. Of course, total extermination is pretty strong language. That's not just simply putting people in jail or in a camp, in a re-education camp. That is, getting rid of them. They create camps which were called filter spaces, where people could be kept until they had seen the light, et cetera, et cetera. They have all these white guard prisoners that some of whom, of course, executed, and the Cheka or the police who oversee all of this. I mean, that's an obvious term. So examples from the Civil War, as Holquist's words show the project of fashioning society by excising particular elements was an intrinsic aspect of Soviet power from the very beginning. But it's not on the scale that would come later. There are lists of people drawn up in the early 1920s that would be used in 1937 and 1938 during the Great Purge. And so when the campaigns of collectivization, which are bloody, which are massacres, come along, the kulakization campaign, get rid of the kulaks, 1929-1930, it becomes on a more urgent and more paranoid scale. a memorandum. This is the kind of stuff that we now know from the archives. A memorandum from March 15th, 1931 states that with regard to the kulaks, the goal of deportation from all regions was, quote, to totally cleanse them of kulaks. And another, slightly earlier, in February, called for them to be, quote, immediately liquidated. We will exile the kulak by thousands and, when necessary, shoot the kulak breed. We will make soap of the kulaks. Our class enemy must be wiped off from the face of the earth. Strong language. And thus, in 1930, more than 20,000 kulaks were sentenced to death. And, of course, many more are gunned down when they protest. And they protest. They kill their animals rather than turn them over to the commissaire. They burn their harvests. They burn their farms. These are weapons of the week, as my dear friend Jim Scott in the political science department would call it. And weakened, indeed, they were, because they're confronting these enormous military forces. But they fight back. You know, they fight back, and they don't go down in a heap without fighting. Now, one of the interesting things about this is, just as, you know, one of the key trends in the end of the 19th century is, of course, the origins of sociology, intellectual trends, the idea of counting and figuring and thinking about contemporary society. Max Weber and all that. I mean, really important stuff, positivism, all of this. And so, this kinds of censuses that developed way before all of this. I mean, the first census, as I said, in France, the first really accurate one outside of municipal ones, is in 1841. But what they do is they use sort of modern tools of censuses, surveys, and questionnaires to get information on the entire population. And you better be damn careful when you write down who you are on one of these forms, when they say, who is your grandfather? What did your grandfather do? what are you going to write? You can't write down he was an industrial worker if he wasn't. What if he's a kulak? What if he's a noble? What if he's an Orthodox priest? Well, you're guilty by association. Once a kulak, once a clergyman, once an aristocrat, by class identity, you are guilty. You are guilty. They used the censuses of 1926 and 1937, and the last one before the war of 1939, as a way of deciding who should get passports and who shouldn't get passports and who should be sent off to wherever. And so they're beginning. By 1934, 27 million people in the Soviet Union had been monitored and given state ID cards. Now, the French, you had to have an ID card also to go from one département to the next. To go from Marseille to Nice, you had to have a passport, an internal passport. But what they do, you know, it's the same state thrust, except it has a murderous outcome. Because if you're classifying people, if you're counting people, if you're registering people, this is way before the quiet violence of the computer, as Michel Perrault memorably put it. But the outcome is very different. And they use archivists. I have friends who are archivists, and they're not going to be doing this kind of thing. These are French archivists. But they're using archivists who, they're fearful for their life. I mean, you're an archivist. You're a middle class, you're an archivist with writing and reading skills. You're potentially an enemy of the state because you're from the wrong social class. And so they say, we want to look at your archives. We want you to find out who's in what category in your region. And you better do it. And archivists in 1939, according to Holquist, identify 108,000 enemies of the people. And once you're classified as an enemy of the people, baby, you're toast. That's it. That's it. You're toast. Now, Sheila Fitzpatrick is a wonderful historian, was one of the first to to study what she calls the extraordinary everydayness of Stalinism. What it was life like in a place where the only way of getting anything and potentially the only way of surviving is your relationship to a bureaucratic figure. Because Stalinism, the essence of state collectivization, of state totalitarianism, is you have to have this enormous bureaucracy. And it's the bureaucracy that calls the shots. The problem. Well, let me put some of the points that are important. In getting by, who are apt to be the militants in all of this? Who are apt to be the true believers in all of this? The most loyal to the project of creating this new world that never came? The answer is young people. Younger people. That there were many cases, of course, of younger people denouncing their parents, being asked to denounce their parents. But the most militant and the most faithful were people who in the 1930s, for example, if they were 25 years old, they didn't really remember the old regime. They didn't remember the czarist autocracy. And they are more likely to think that there's nothing wrong with trying to decide who still has religious icons on their walls, whose parents religiously went to church. And so the young people were more apt to be the militants in all of this. And if you were a militant, what you did was you denounced class enemies, these kulaks and the priests, members of the pre-revolutionary nobility, former capitalists. But again, once a capitalist, you are always a capitalist. Once a kulak, you are always a kulak. And people who had been declared as non-toilers, that is, not people who are not really workers or really peasants, who are kulaks, they are deprived of the vote, not that elections subsequently meant anything, in the Soviet Union as early as the Constitution of 1918. And so these young militants undertake a war on bourgeois specialists. Now, one of the problems, of course, with the campaign for rapid industrialization is they're really torn because you need these bourgeois specialists because they're technocrats, and they're the ones that have to keep up the production toll. The production count, they have to keep it up there. But then you go into this period, you say, well, you can't have a bunch of bourgeois specialists who are educated. And so those people get liquidated, maybe not killed, but get removed, and then they will bring in and replace them with sometimes peasants who had absolutely no education, which is not their fault at all. The Soviets do educate people in this period. There's a huge increase in literacy in this period, but they're turning over important management positions within the Soviet Union in this push for rapid industrialization of people that can't read and write and really just don't have the kind of finesse or the kind of ability to do it. And then, of course, that causes all sorts of problems. And of course, the bureaucracy is increasingly filled with people who are not competent, but are there because of their party loyalty. And if you aren't loyal to the party, there's nowhere you're going to go. How does this affect ordinary Soviet citizens? Well, there's constant propaganda, talk about the radiant future, enormous sacrifices now will be worth it in the end. I mean, Marx, after all, said this in scientific socialism, it's going to take a long time. Thus, if you see these, and I've been on the Moscow subway about a long time ago, but these sort of heroic murals of the Soviet worker, the Stakhovenite, I mean, don't write it down, but I think he's in the book, but this guy Stakhovanov was a guy, or whatever his name was, who had apparently, you know, set a world record by extracting the most coal any human had ever done. And of course, it was basically made up. And he became this kind of image of hard work. But I'll tell you, if you go to a lot of this Art Deco murals in Detroit, Michigan, and the kind, or for example, I'm not making this as an analogy, but there was the equivalent under National Socialism also, the idea of the German worker, you know, toiling away and all that with the interests of the state. But basically, it's the idea that Russia could be moved by hard work out of backwardness toward this radiant future. It does keep people going. There's always this contrast between then, the old days, the bad old days when these folks ruled, the netmen and the kulaks and the aristocracy and all of that, and the inevitable future. That the landlords were gone, there's collective ownership of the means of production, so everything has got to be okay. The motto is, the party is always right, and you better believe it. And the state shaped the way people lived. Now, a part of it, of course, I mean, those people lived through the purge. I mean, there's just, well, I'll tell you a story. I had this colleague a long, long time ago when I first came here who grew up in Moscow in the 1930s because his father was the Persian ambassador to Moscow. And this was, you know, in the purges, people were denouncing their parents and things like that. People were being taken away in the night, and there were boots in the hall, and it was a pretty damn scary time to live. And one day he was in this big school. He was in college, which is middle school, so he's 12 years old, basically. And he is sitting in one of these big buildings there, and the bell rings. You go from one class to the next class. And the bell rang, and the guy who's sitting in front of him, 12-year-old boy, gets up. He puts his cartable down, his book carrier down, and he goes out. They're on the fifth floor. He goes to the stairwell, and he jumps over to his death, just like that. He stepped over the thing, fell. If you're 12 years old, you're going to remember that kind of thing. He didn't know, because you didn't discuss such things, whether he had denounced his parents and felt badly about it, whether his parents had been taken away. He didn't have any idea where they were. But this was one of the tragedies also. And a lot of it is, you know, of course, a lot of it is self-deception. And these were very, very, very poor people. And you believe in the radiant future. Because this is a very, very poor place. And you saw these Stalin skyscrapers raising up. There's a big debate in Warsaw whether the one that's there should be kept. And you saw more literacy. And you saw sometimes products on the market. But the deception was there. The great hopes were there. The reality was completely different. You would have bizarre things happen. Suddenly, I mean, you have state planning. So for a while, there were all these sort of red female stockings were on the market because that was supposed to be cool, and you had a lot of Western visitors who had seen these same female red stockings, which were very much in Paris and Berlin. But this wasn't Paris and Berlin. This was Moscow. So suddenly you have a lot of that. Someone thought, well, ketchup will look good to the outsiders when they come. And so they start producing ketchup, but there's nothing to put the ketchup on. And the most ridiculous example I've ever heard is that they start producing lots of bathtubs because, you know, people are waiting in line to get apartments, which is true until 1992. They're waiting in line to get apartments, though things got a lot better, you know, after World War II, but still. And so if you're going to have an apartment that is a progress, the radiant future, you got to have a bathtub. So they produce all these bathtubs, but they forget to produce corks or stoppers. So for a long time, you had people that were lucky enough to have bathtubs, but the water just runs out, and they could show them off to their friends. But it simply doesn't work. But there is the illusion, and I'm going to have to end with this because I went too long earlier. There's more to say, but there's always more to say. There was the illusion, and there were lots of true believers. And people who also wanted a radiant future, and who, you know, I mean, in the 1960s, we were also, the late 1960s, please, not the early ones, and the 70s, we were all dealing with you know, our ideology of the week. And I had an uncle who meant a great deal to me, who was a communist, and he was trained in Berlin as a psychoanalyst, and he. Uh, He worked for Rotfana, which is the paper, and he claimed to have known Dmitrov, who was an important communist, and he was a true believer, and he was a true believer always. At the end of his life, he ended up passing, or having his wife pass, Save the Whale petitions, and he was no longer a communist. But I remember when I was a little boy, him telling me that people trying to escape from communism were psychotic. The people trying to get over the wall in Berlin were psychotic for trying to leave this radiant future of a workers' paradise. And there were a lot of true believers. These people, a lot of them, and I'm not dissing my uncle, whom I love deeply and who meant a great deal in my life, and especially my aunt, but they believed, and people would go to these show trials, and they would see people saying, yes, I was in cahoots with a Romanian fascist, or with a Dutch fascist, or with a Georgian nationalist, or something like that. And they would admit to all sorts of things, possibly hoping it was going to save their life. And it didn't. It never did. And they were executed, and Stalin executed them all. He executed the entire general staff, practically, of the army. And one of the most amazing things about the Second World War is how the Red Army, how they not only survived, but won, and retraining people. There weren't any admirals left or won. There was nobody left. He'd killed them all. He'd killed them all. But people continued to believe. They believed. And the whole idea, the whole phrase, maybe you've heard of it, is the phrase, a Potemkin village. And I guess that's a good place to end. A Potemkin village. If you're watching an old TV Western and you see a facade that, got the bar, and you've got Miss Kitty, and you've got, all of this, and a few people, punching each other out. There's nothing behind it. It's just all a fraud. It's nothing. And they would bring these visitors from the West in this brave new industrial world, and they'd see parts of towns that had been reshaped, and they'd meet the first literate people in a family. It was very compelling. It was very true. I mean, some good things happened too, but they were far outweighed by the bad things. But a Potemkin village would be, you'd go and you'd see this facade, and you'd be whisked through, and this is where the children's railroad will be, and this is where the kindergarten is going to be. It's always the going to be, and it never happened. And that, I suppose, is the tragedy of the Russian Revolution. Arguably, maybe, who knows, a good idea gone terribly, terribly bad.